Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, a quick word about Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte. No subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. I know you're using that Google ecosystem. Get that multi-device integration, you guys. And for a limited time, you can get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/longform. That's g.co/play/longform. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. Also sponsoring the show today, Stitcher Premium. If you have not joined Stitcher Premium yet, now is the time. There's two reasons to join. One is they've got ad-free episodes of hundreds of your favorite shows, including Comedy Bang Bang and WTF with Marc Maron. There's also tons of exclusive content. I am seeing here that they have 21,000 hours, which seems like a ton, but a lot of this exclusive content is fantastic. And as the name implies, you can't get it anywhere else. Go try Stitcher Premium. You can do it for free for a month with the promo code LONGFORM. Go to stitcherpremium.com. Again, the promo code is LONGFORM, and you can try it out for a month. Here's our show. Hello, welcome to the LONGFORM podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm sitting here with just one co-host, Evan Ratliff. How are you, man?
I'm good, Max. Thanks for coming to my living room to record this. I've gotten so lazy that now I insist the studio come to me.
We should acknowledge that there is a third co-host who's not Aaron. Aaron's on vacation, but Henry, Evan's incredible cat, is here with us. Evan, this week on the show, also with us, Brian Fogel, director of the documentary Icarus.
I am very excited about this. I'll tell you, Max, that when I saw this documentary, it had already won the Oscar for Best Documentary. I was not really aware of that or anything about it. And for people who haven't seen it, you should stop this right now and go see it, because I feel like it's an incredible experience. If you don't know anything about what's going to happen, there's an insane twist in this story. But for those who are going to listen to the podcast right now, we should probably set it up a little.
Yeah, we should just give them the twist. So Brian is a very serious amateur cyclist. And his idea for the movie was in the wake of all the Lance Armstrong doping revelations. He decided that he was going to dope and see what effect it had on his performance. And so he went looking for a coach, someone who could guide him in the most cutting edge doping technology there was. And he found this guy who was running the anti-doping agency in Moscow. And the first half an hour, 40 minutes of the movie are the two of them having this funny, friendly relationship about doping, and it's all kind of above board. And then it turns out that this guy is the mastermind of the massive Russian doping scandal that was uncovered and ended up with Russia being banned from the last Olympics, all this stuff. And Brian ends up being this guy's lifeline, and he flees Russia. He's under very serious threat from Vladimir Putin. He's now currently in whatever the equivalent of witness protection is. It's crazy. Yeah. It's a fucking crazy story.
When you're watching it happen, you think this can't possibly be real.
Yeah. And it's one of these things where, and Brian and I talked about it in the interview, he set out to do one thing and then it turned, and you can kind of see the moment in the film where he realizes oh, my first idea is not the idea anymore. I got to just do this. And it was great. It was really fun to talk to him about it. It's a wild, holy shit story.
There's one more thing we should mention about this particular episode.
We should. It is also an episode, or it is originally an episode of another podcast called You Can't Make This Up, which is a podcast that's being produced by Netflix. The conceit of that show is that different podcasters every episode interview filmmakers of Netflix documentaries. Listeners to Longform may be familiar with You Can't Make This Up because they have advertised on our program a few times. And I would just like to make clear that they are not paying for us to put this through the feed or anything. I had a really good time talking to Brian. It felt like a Longform episode, and so we're sharing it here.
Max, how many podcasts are you involved with?
Plead the fifth, man. Plead the fifth. But one of them that you should check out is this one, You Can't Make This Up.
You know what else you can't make up, Max?
Tell me, man. Tell me.
A great book festival without a great sponsor.
Hell of a segue, man. I'll tell you what, my favorite book festival in America is the Decatur Book Festival.
Far and away, unparalleled.
You and I were there last year. We brought a whole bunch of authors, our favorite authors, to the Decatur Book Festival over Labor Day as part of the Read This Summer program, which is sponsored by MailChimp. They are running it back. We were like, we'll do it. They were like, we're good. So Shea Serrano of The Ringer is curated a fantastic lineup.
You know Shea Serrano is going to have good picks.
Yeah.
Probably better picks than us. That's not true. I shouldn't disparage our picks. Our picks were incredible.
No, he will just be a better time. Everyone will have a better time because it's Shay.
That's true.
But if you are looking for something to read this summer, go to readthissummer.com. Check out one of these books that Shay has picked out. There's all kinds of fantastic stuff.
And now here's Max with Brian Fogel.
Well, hey, Brian.
Hey, Max. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well.
I'm doing good. They're all set up here in my house, and I have a dog, Max, who's right by my side. So that was a good Max environment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like the Max vibes to be good. Well, I like everyone else in the world, and the Academy was just blown away by your film. Congratulations on the award. How is it? How does winning an Oscar change your life?
Well, first of all, thanks. It was an incredibly humbling experience. And, you know, it was a tremendous amount of support around the project and, you know, just an amazing team of people that came together to help the film get the recognition that ultimately happened with the Academy. So that was just awesome. And, you know, I guess how it feels different is, I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's, you know, it's like I have this Oscar in my house and so I walk by it every day. There it is. And,
so every morning I wake up, I go over, I kiss it.
Well, no, that was just for first couple weeks. First couple weeks of having it, I just wouldn't let it leave my sight. So I'd bring it to the bed with me. I'd put it in the kitchen. I'd put it in the trunk of my car. But, but ultimately, I think it's only a wonderful tool to be able to continue to do work and to be able to continue to do projects that inspire you. So, for me, I think winning the Oscar has just opened up doors for me to continue to do work.
This is probably like a corny question, and I chalk it up to me watching too many like sappy movies or something, but when you're like standing up there, is there any part of you that thinks back to like the original genesis of the film and when you first had that idea and like whatever you needed to do to take it out and get funding and pitch it around, like to think about how wildly it changed and that you're up on there, like are you going through that process at all, or is it just kind of like a holy shit moment?
I think I've been going through that process throughout the entire process. I think for me the most surreal thing about it was when I started on making Icarus, you know, a little over 4 years ago. I was probably going through one of the hardest creative and financial periods of my life, and really trying to figure out if I was going to be able to continue to be a filmmaker and be able to get funding for projects. And so to have that experience 4 years later, to be on the stage winning an Oscar when I started the film coming from a very different kind of emotional and financial state in my life and creative space, that was pretty amazing. And so I've always I've thought about that throughout this entire experience. And
was it I guess I didn't totally know that. Was it close? I mean, were you really close to not making films anymore?
Yeah, you know, I did a play that was very successful. It played in New York for 3.5 years and Los Angeles and all over the country. And then I did a book, and then I had directed what was my first feature film, a comedy, which was an adaptation of the play. And And long story short, the film I took bad money into the film. The financier didn't want to sell it. There was just all these, you know, stories that you hear, and it didn't open up doors in my career as I had hoped it to. And I spent essentially a couple of years after that process trying to figure out how I was going to restart. And cycling for me had always been kind of my therapy in life. And even though I think in Icarus it kind of shows, oh, I was racing bikes. I mean, the reality was is that I'd stopped racing bikes when I was 20 years old, and I had gotten very back into cycling, kind of as a therapeutic kind of way, as I was figuring out how I was going to write the next chapter in my life. And then, you know, Armstrong confessed, and I started getting this idea in my mind that, hey, we've never seen kind of a supersize me-esque journey in the world of performance-enhancing drugs, which, you know, obviously is got a universal worldwide curiosity to it. And also I was looking at what I viewed was a totally ineffective anti-doping system on a worldwide basis, because despite the government and WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, parading that they had essentially, you know, caught the bad guy, they really hadn't caught him at all. It was a confession based on all of his teammates ratting him out in exchange for their own immunity. So I was going, wait, not what's wrong with Lance Armstrong, what's wrong with this global anti-doping system that can't catch a guy after testing him 500 times? And to me, that felt like that was going to be an interesting story and hopefully would make for a compelling film.
And how long were you working on that version of the film before, like, your story turned?
Well, I was working on that version of the film. There was about a year for me of essentially coming up with the idea and then figuring out how I was going to get, you know, a first round of money to kind of just start in on the process of filming. And so it took me about a year to get the first tranche of financing to kind of start on that journey. And that really started in April 2014. And I had already talked to Gregory Rodchenkov months before I'd actually started shooting. So there was kind of the initial seeds of it. But I didn't know where that was going to, you know, lead to, or whether or not it would bear fruit until, you know, November of 2015. So, you know, so here, May, June, July, August, September, you know, a year and a half into making the first film, you know, is when essentially I realized that the first film that I was making was going to be completely inconsequential to what the film would ultimately become. And
that moment is one I really want to dig into for a second, because I'm interested in a whole slew of things. And one is there any part of you that wonders what this sort of first version in its entirety would have looked like, how that would have played as a doc? Like, do you think about that at all? It's like, when you switch gears in the way that you had to, like, do you mourn the lost narrative somehow?
No, I don't mourn the lost narrative. And there was so many moments during that really first year where I had this kind of like, you know, what the hell am I doing?
Were any of those moments while you were like, you know, sticking testosterone in your ass?
Yeah, it was one after the other. And then, you know, I had Gregory involved, you know, very, very early on in the process, even before I had started doping. But to me, in the early stages, the film that I was making and the success of the film hinged on my ability to essentially dope and evade detection. And that, you know, Gregory, of course, was the co-conspirator, you know, sideman in the project, but ultimately whether or not the film was going to work hinged on that premise for me. And so, you know, after I completed the second Haute Route in 2015 and didn't perform as well as I had hoped, there was kind of a huge burden and what was feeling like an elephant that I wasn't quite sure if I was going to be able to pull off the film as I had hoped for. And at the same time, I had already been interviewing all the guys that had been investigating Gregory and had been investigating, you know, the Russian, you know, state-sponsored doping system. So,
right.
So I had been planting that foot, and I had been doing that, you know, really through the entire process that I was doping. But I didn't know where that was going to go to at that point. You know, what the investigation was going to find, you know, and whether or not that potential storyline was going to pay off. So, I mean, there was just so many times that I had self-doubt, but you know, I kept going. I was, you know, I was on this journey and I wasn't going to stop.
Help me just understand that last thing a little bit more, if you can. Like, how do you get over that moment of doubt? You've started on one course, and I it's interesting to hear you say that, actually, that, like, you know, you were having those conversations already. You were interested in WADA already, and like, those tracks were laid on some level. But, like, I can just imagine, especially if you felt like this was, like, you know, a pretty important shot for you in your career, and you've gone and sold this kind of, like, supersize me version of the film. Like, I can imagine, at least, that it would be pretty nerve-wracking to feel the ground shifting under you. And I'm just kind of, I'm interested in how you get through that.
Well, I mean, I, first and foremost is I didn't, as I was setting out on making the film, creatively and career-wise, I didn't really have, like, a backup plan. So it wasn't like this was, like, a side project to me, or this was something that I was, you know, kind of doing in between other work. This was what I was doing, and this was, you know, I had essentially created what was a full-time job for myself in making this film. So as the story just kept, you know, unfolding, it was like, okay, well, this is the journey that I'm on. I'm going to continue to follow it. And then I was very, very fortunate that Impact Partners, who came in as my financier after the first year of making the film, realized and understood the story that we were in. But there was a long period of time also that none of us were really thinking so much about purely the film. It was really that we were in a real world crisis. Right. Gregory's life was essentially in my hands, and there was a huge amount of trust there, and we were dealing with a true, real unfolding situation. The stakes were high, and so during that period of time, the film became secondary, but I always made sure that there was a camera there. So it was like every day we were in this, right, like, you know, daily crisis management and how we were going to bring this story forward. But I made sure that there was always a camera there to essentially record what was going on.
How did the people around you, how did their feelings about what you were doing change as the stakes changed? Like, there's this moment, like 20 minutes into the movie, it's right when you find out that Gregory is being investigated by WADA, and you're talking to Ben Stone about it?
Right.
I mean, you know, there might be someone else out there that might be a better decision or choice. You're using this guy as your outlet for coaching. I mean, tell me, and what you're comfortable with.
Well, you know, I mean, like, here's how I'm kind of looking at it.
You know, you can find someone else.
I guess you're calling doping doctors. I don't know what you would label Gregory. I mean, is he a biochemist? I don't even know. It doesn't even matter. I don't like this shit.
It seems like people in your life weren't too into the original plan, weren't too into you hanging out with Gregory. And then once the whole tenor changed, what did people around you think? Not your producing partners, but like your friends?
You know, it's Most of what we were going through, I kept pretty close to my vest, and among only those that were working on the film and the project, because this was serious. So it's not like at that point, I was talking to all these guys and telling them what was going on. Right.
Is it weird though to go get dinner with somebody and just like shoot the shit while you're like trying to keep a man from getting killed?
Well, I think the interesting thing is through the the process. Obviously, my parents, I'd call up my parents and be like, oh my God, you don't understand what's going on. This is really serious. And I think my dad, kind of always being a skeptic, was like, oh yeah, and they had actually met Gregory, and so nobody could kind of fathom what I knew and how kind of serious and far-reaching this was, and essentially kind of how big this scandal was. And anybody that I kind of shared with this outside of my creative team, like my family or stuff, would always like downplay this, like I was essentially, like a conspiracy right. theorist or something. So that was interesting. And then I think, among athletes and guys who are riding with, cycling with, and there was only a handful knew that I was like essentially taking PEDs, even though I was an amateur and even though I was doing this purely from an investigative point of view, they would like get into like this like ethical conundrum about it. and I always thought that was very strange, because if you have an ethical conundrum that sports should be clean, and you're an athlete and you're not taking anything, which I believe in that, then my process of wanting to show that the system was a fraud, I would have thought that other athletes would have been excited about, and yet they were looking at it that I was like a cheater, and I was consistently going, I'm not a cheater. I'm not going into competitions where I'm being paid money. I'm not a sponsored athlete. I'm a filmmaker and I'm investigating something, and I'm showing, hopefully, the fallacies of a system which is actually going to help protect you and help you, if you're a clean athlete, ensure that competition is clean. And so I encountered that many times along the journey, and I always thought that was very strange, that these guys couldn't like step out of their own shoes to understand what was the bigger process.
What do you think was threatening to them?
Well, I think what was threatening, and I've kind of continued to encounter this, and I'll share with you one story just from this past week through the film, and then in the last year, I've gotten to know Lance Armstrong. So I went cycling with him last week, and
that must have been pretty cool.
Yeah, and it was really cool. And so, love or hate Lance, for me, it's like, wow, I'm cycling with, the guy who, regardless of anything, he won the Tour de France 7 times. Yes, I mean,
shooting hoops with LeBron.
Yeah, and to me, whether or not LeBron James hypothetically, is taking something or not, that didn't diminish the feat of winning 7 Tour de Frances, knowing that everybody else was essentially doing the same thing. And if you go back historically, it really is arguably a level playing field, because there was nobody else to give those titles to, and there's still nobody else to give those titles to. So
how's Lance Armstrong doing these days?
Yeah, well, hang on. So anyway, so I post a photo of Lance and I on Instagram riding, and I get like a couple angry text messages from, from ex-pro cyclists that I had somehow like stabbed them in the back. And I'm thinking to myself, not only have I not stabbed you in the back, had the Lance story not happened, then Icarus and all these revelations would have never happened. I would have never started on that journey. I would have never met Gregory. I wouldn't have been able to bring what was a fraud, on a level a million times bigger than Lance forward. And in so doing, that's helped protect, clean athletes. That's helped you know, hopefully make changes in the system and bring awareness globally to a bigger problem. So it's always been interesting to me how short-sighted I've found many people in this journey, rather than looking at the bigger perspective outside of themselves.
Well, he also, I mean, Armstrong in particular, just, he's such like a trigger. He just represents so much to people, I think. You know, he's just like, he's a symbol in all of these ways. Over and over and over again in Icarus, we see him say, I've tested positive every time, you know, look into the camera and say, I never doped.
Right.
Say I'm clean.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether you think that in those moments he knew he was lying, or whether he had found a lie to tell himself that was so powerful that he believed what he was saying.
Well, I mean, you would need to ask Lance that, because I certainly wouldn't know that. But I believe that, you know, we get into in Icarus the whole theme of Orwell and doublethink and 1984, which is Gregory's favorite book and was kind of his roadmap for life. And I think that in many ways that probably, you know, mirrored Lance's journey and you know, the idea of the more and more you tell a lie, that ultimately you start believing in its truth. And that certainly was kind of the roadmap of Gregory and his journey and Winston Smith in 1984, which is this, you know, this doublethink, which is, you know, continuing to repeat a lie until it becomes a truth. I can certainly understand theoretically where Lance was coming from all those years, that, you know, once he was caught up in that and once he had become a champion and the sponsorships and also the belief that everybody else was doing the same thing or were doing the same thing. And I could see why the defense of that lie occurred, not to justify it or not to to validate it. But I think I could understand what that might be like to be caught into something like that, because that certainly was Gregory's path as well.
It is about doublethink. I think that's a much finer point to put on my like clumsily phrased question. When did you decide to use 1984 as such a like kind of key device in the film? Did that come late or did that come early?
That came late, and I wish I could truly take credit for that, but I can't. Gregory traveled with 1984. And at the time, you know, I had multiple editors on the project, and one of my lead editors, by the name of Kevin Klauber, looking through all the footage, had really grasped on that Gregory was always quoting Orwell, and it was always quoting, you know, out of 1984, and he had been doing it, you know, through the entire time that I met him. I mean, and you know, like long before he had fled to the U.S. And I remember Kevin saying to me, you know, hey, Brian, have you read 1984? And I go, yeah, I mean, in high school. He goes, you know, you should go back and look at this. And I went back and started looking at it. And there was, I think, kind of a oh my God, light bulb moment among myself and the creative team, that essentially what was happening in our story mimicked, you know, 1984, and that Gregory in a way was Winston Smith, and that narratively the construct mimicked the three stages of Winston Smith, learning, understanding, acceptance. And those stages of Winston Smith's journey was truly mimicking Gregory's journey, and here Gregory was the living embodiment of doublethink. So all those kind of revelations led us to think that this could be a narrative arc, that this could be a construct that we could frame the story around. And literally a couple days before bringing Gregory into protective custody, dropping him off at the airport, which was in July of 2016, We brought him into our editing offices and found a quiet room, brought in the sound guys, and recorded him reading various passages, which we had highlighted in 1984, for, you know, a couple of hours. And then over the next year, as we crafted the film, these passages we were able to frame a story around and had his, you know, audio of recording that as the narrator.
Can I ask you another process question that's right in line with like that evolution?
Sure.
When he started, at first he was like a character and an advisor in the film, right? And then he kind of becomes its subject, and then he kind of becomes your friend, and then he becomes a victim and someone who's in danger. There's so many different roles as a filmmaker in that process, right? Like, you're starting to wear all these different hats. And as you were saying earlier, like at some point the film actually becomes of secondary importance. When you start realizing that like this guy's life is kind of in your hands, how do you figure out how to protect him? Like what do you do? There's a moment where you reference that you talk to Ben Wisner, Snowden's lawyer. And I just like, I wonder like once you realize how high the stakes have gotten, like literally in a practical sense, how you figure out how to protect someone like in that situation.
Well, I think that's two parts of that answer, which is first, the desire to protect him. And you know, there's a scene in Icarus where the water report comes out, he's forced to resign from the lab, the lab's accreditation is pulled, and Putin is on television basically saying that we deny this, none of this is true, but if any of this happened, it'll be the individual that is held responsible, and punishment is absolute. And here's Grigory in Moscow with two FSB agents essentially living in his home, quote-unquote, guarding him. And that statement by Putin and what was going on was essentially his death sentence, and they were going to throw him under the bus. And so as I understood that very quickly, the idea that I wasn't going to help him, to me, never really crossed my mind, because here he had been my advisor and helping me without literally a dime of money. There was never any financial consideration. He had just been helping me and advising me and filming with me as a friend. You know, I mean, it was truly as simple as that.
Why do you think he did it? Like, why did he start doing it with you?
You know, I've asked him that many times, and I think that I think that he liked, and you know what he said to me is that he liked that I was devious. He liked that I was. you know, and in his mind, I was an amateur athlete, so, you know, I wasn't a professional. So, hey, there was, you know, this gray area loophole that you could theoretically help me, you know, at least in his mind, which, of course, that was certainly a conundrum that we had in before the film took the turn, which was, I was like, how are we going to ever put this out? Grigory will lose his job. He'll be, you know, exiled. He'll be, you know, because everything that he's helping with, he shouldn't have been doing to begin with. But, you know, we had this trust, and I think that he, in his mind also, you know, maybe there is, you know, a manifestation of what was happening. And I think he probably realized, and I know that he realized that, you know, the noose was kind of tightening around him. This investigation was unfolding. There had been this German documentary. And on top of that, he was fed up with his job. He was fed up with the ministry. He was fed up that he was no longer a scientist. He was essentially a guy whose job was dumping out, you know, dirty urine for clean urine. And I think all those elements probably led him to help me, that it seemed like a new adventure. But it was ultimately, you know, his help and trust that we established that made it very easy for me to get him that ticket, to get him here and protect him, because he had been such, you know, an extraordinary friend to me. The idea that I wasn't going to be a friend to him didn't really cross my mind.
Yeah, it's funny thinking about, I watched the movie twice before you and I talked, and watching his introduction again, knowing like where the story's going to go, you know, you really read it differently. Like the first time I experienced it, he kind of seems like someone who's like, he's kind of just in it for like the ego boost, you know,
right.
Like he's good at it and he likes talking about it and he wants to get seen. And he seems kind of like oddly like, nonchalant about it. And then the second time around, knowing where it was going to go, there's this other element to it. Like maybe part of why he was so game to talk to you was because he was trying to figure out how he was going to get out. Maybe it was just one path, you know, one possibility. Maybe there's like a bunch of hands, but maybe you represented some chance that could work, you know?
Not wax philosophical or spiritual, but there's so many things that kind of happen in the journey of life that you might look at that could be random or by chance, but ultimately have a bigger purpose. And so the idea that I come into Gregory's life and Gregory comes into my life at that perfect timing. That he helps me in my journey, and then I help him in his journey. All these kind of just different things that transpired, really transpired. Almost feels like fate. I mean, that we were meant to come into each other's lives to help each other. It certainly is kind of a crazy story when you look at how it all came together, and it happened. So I don't think Gregory knows exactly, you know, why or how he did everything, other than he did. He trusted me, I trusted him, and ultimately I protected him, and my team protected him, and he had protected me.
At any point, as these roles were shifting and you were going from like director, subject, like advisor, athlete to friends and then protector, like at any point did he become a collaborator in the filmmaking? Like I'm thinking about like the big interview where it walks you through swapping urine and admits to everything. And maybe we could just take a second and listen to that really quickly.
This was named Operation Sochi Resultat. In Russian, Resultat means to achieve positive results.
So you need clean urines.
I need a clean urine for each candidate.
So every single Russian athlete under the state-sponsored doping, you had clean samples of their urine being held.
Yes.
So that if an athlete, anybody needed to be swapped, you could swap them.
Yes. But in Sochi.
So like when you sat down for that big interview, had you guys talked about
it? Oh,
yeah. Was it planned?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there, you know, I shot actually multiple interviews that were, you know, various kind of versions of the tell-all, because there was so much to tell. And before we sat down and did that interview, we had had multiple discussions, and I'd actually shot stuff not all lit and ready for that in various kind of iterations of it. And certainly as we got into the editing of that story, we probably even pulled audio from a couple different interviews. But the unraveling of that really was over a couple months' time of once he had got to Los Angeles. And I think Gregory's decision to become a whistleblower and his desire to expose this truth. And as that desire in him grew, you know, are kind of continuing to shoot interviews with him as he became more and more open about what had happened and what he had been involved in. That continued kind of our journey of interviewing. And obviously, the biggest revelation or fraud being what he had been involved with in Sochi, and that he was essentially the architect of that plan.
Do you think, in this way that we've talked about, where like the stakes were kind of building on themselves and the ground was shifting, and all of a sudden, as a viewer at least, you realize like, oh, this is a much bigger deal than I thought even a few minutes ago in the film. Do you think that he was aware of the stakes the whole time?
Absolutely. And the funny thing, or not the funny thing, but the reality is that Gregory kept telling me the stakes consistently. And I knew what the stakes were, but, you know, he would be like, you know, this is a nuclear bomb. This is a big bomb. This is a huge bomb. This is going to change the world. This is the biggest fraud in history. This is the demise of the Olympics. This is going to destroy WADA. This is going to destroy Russia. This is like, and so Gregory was always kind of reminding me of how big this was, you know, and I knew that, but, you know, there's also kind of the idea of, you know, hey, somebody telling you something. So, you know, if I'm saying, Max, you're never going to believe this. This is really big, you know. And then, right. and then, you know, kind of the understanding of, whoa, this is really big. And then, of course, the media and news and investigation and New York Times and everything going, yeah, this is really big. And then all of it being proven true. So, I think Gregory from day one knew, you know, kind of how big this was and how big of a fraud, and held those cards to his chest a little bit initially, and then as our trust built and his desire to become a whistleblower and expose this fraud grew, you know, he knew that there were, you know, essentially many chapters to play, and right. and those chapters have continued to, you know, to unfold. I mean, he was just recently coming very public about various players on Russia's World Cup soccer team that he had been swapping urine for. You know, there's still pieces of his story that just keep unfolding.
It's so that's funny to hear you say that. There's something about, like, part of what makes it hard to know where the stakes are in the film is that all of the, like, Olympic and WADA officials, basically every single one of them is such like a like careful older white man with gray hair, and they all talk in like such monotones, you know, that it's sort of hard to know how important or eventful or impactful what they're saying are. Like, the whole culture of it is so like neutral and monotone. And Gregory's so not that. He's so like animated and all over the place. And that scene when he sees the Time stories is really, I think, what I was asking about, because that seems like one moment where it sort of hits him, the magnitude of what he's doing. It's striking to me that his first reaction was just like, that story's so good. You know, like, this is so good. And, yeah. And honestly, Brian, what it made me think about was what his reaction to your film would be. Do you know if he's seen it?
Yeah, no, he's seen it. I know that his lawyer showed it to him, so I don't think he's ever got to experience it in a theater on the big screen. I know he hasn't. But I know that he was incredibly moved by it, and I'm really taken by it. And I think he was kind of overwhelmed emotionally by how it came together and how, you know, we portrayed him in the film and et cetera.
I assume that you don't know where he is and you haven't talked to him. And even if you did know and you had, you couldn't tell me. But imagine that he's, you know, somewhere wherever you get put when you're in witness protection, and he just happens to be a listener to this podcast and subscribing on his iPhone and listening. Is there something you'd want to say to him after all this?
I mean, I think I would say to him, you know, I don't know if I can curse, but, you know.
You can.
I think I would just say, holy fuck, man. look what you did, you know. No, I mean, I am constantly concerned for his emotional and mental well-being. And, you know, being a whistleblower is in many ways a very selfless act, because if you look at kind of the history of many whistleblowers, is they pay, you know, a huge cost. And when you look at Gregory's journey, outside of the notoriety, recognition, whatever you might want to call it, pseudo-celebrity, behind that, there's a very heavy price, which is this guy is going to have a target on his back for the rest of his life. Certainly, we've seen this, you know, in the case of Skirpal or Alexander Litvinenko or any number of Russians that we've, you know, that we've read about that have met untimely demises. And he is isolated from his family. He's isolated from ever returning to that country. And my understanding is that, you know, he lives most of his days kind of in solitude, because, you know, he can't be roaming around in public. Apparently, they put him in a bulletproof vest when he goes out, and you know, his lawyer and FBI and whatever have continued to facilitate him being able to do interviews and press to keep the story forward, but. It's a big price to pay.
Do you miss the guy?
Yeah, of course. You know, I worry more or think about more what is 2 years, 3 years down the line look for him, and I think that's a heavy toll.
I got one more question, Brian, and then I'll let you go. Thinking down the line for him is one thing. Thinking down the line for you is another. And I believe in that stuff too, like things happening for a reason. And it does seem like from a strictly like narrative perspective, from a filmmaking perspective, something miraculous happened to you, you know? I mean, you just... the story of a lifetime just kind of unfolded in front of you and took you on this crazy path. And, you know, you got that Oscar that you sleep with every night. And
not anymore. That was only the first couple of weeks.
Oh, right. My bad. Well, here's the thing I was wondering is like, what do you do now, man? Like you can't recreate that. Right. And I know some people who have had, that kind of public success. And I know that your phone starts ringing and your email is crazy and all these offers pour in, but how do you follow up something so incredible and so impossible to engineer?
That's a good question. And I think that, you know, I've experienced this in a much smaller capacity before, where I did this play called Jutopia. You know, is a big success, and in the success of that, which kind of went on for years, I found myself kind of trapped by that success. I liken it to kind of being Ross, David Schwimmer on Friends, or Jason Alexander on Seinfeld, where, you know, you're always going to be that person, no matter, you know, how many times you might try to reinvent yourself. And that can kind of burden you, because it's this feeling of you know, of imminent failure. And I think with Icarus, having went through that once with Utopia, I know that I'm not going to replicate that success. I am not going to very unlikely find a story like this again. And so you have to kind of understand that creatively and just try to kind of push forward with what inspires you. So, you know, for me, like the follow-up is to produce doc projects that I'm passionate about, and I've got a scripted feature that I'm working to get going, which is a true story. And so figuring out kind of how to navigate that, knowing that whatever I do is not going to be Icarus, but hopefully, it'll be its own thing. And, you know, and you just move forward creatively and try not to worry too much about the overall outcome other than to do your best.
Hey, thank you, man. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Max. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer. This show also had help from Barry Finkel. Thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp, Google Play, and Stitcher Premium. And thanks very much to Brian Fogel. If you have not seen Icarus, it is streaming right now on Netflix, along with a bunch of other great documentaries. Go check it out. We'll see you next week.